Good morning. It's Sunday, March 13th. Somewhat of a small crowd today, probably because I'm still going to attribute this to people either not having moved their clocks yet or just plain old oversleeping, which is possible. I mean,
which is star students showed up.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming out here. So this might turn into more of a discussion, which is absolutely fine. We're going to continue along with Adam Furtzicker's book of Exclusion and Hierarchy, Orthodoxy, Non-Observance, and the Emergency of Modern Jewish Identity, for a couple of reasons. One, the more I read it, the more I really like the book and how he's doing things. Two, since this is an area that I don't consider myself to be that much of an expert in, I figure I can rely on someone who's done a really good book, and there's no sense in me reinventing the wheel, especially now as, you know, the show rabbi here at Stanton. And this week my main concern is getting Megillah prepped for Purim, because I've never done that before. And then in the next couple of weeks we got Pesach coming up. Right, next week there's not going to be class because we got Purim. Davening's going to be at 9.
So forget next Sunday.
Well, I mean, you can come to hear the Megillah reading, but there's not going to be a class next week. And then we get into super crazy, you know, Pesach prep. So it allows me to, you know, rely on someone else at a time where, you know, I don't have enough time on my own to do a lot of the original research. When we finish, I guess, or when we get to a certain point in Furtzicker's book and we get to more of the modern period, then we're going to change to, you know, kind of what prompted all of this, and get into some of the response and see some of the more later day response to Inside, which I'm not sure if he gets to.
Let me just
I can pause this for a second. So that'll, you know, set up the next couple of weeks, or at least until Pesach and a little bit afterwards. So in the meantime, today we're going to do his section on the Chatam Sofer. Put in a brief biography here, courtesy of Wikipedia and the Bar Ilan CD, to give us a little bit of time context.
When you say Chatam Sofer, the first thing in my mind is the guy saying everything that's new is forbidden.
Yeah.
Simplistic type of guy.
Ah, you're familiar with the statement. Excellent. We're going to get there later. It's one of the things he, in terms of an aphorism, it's one of the things he's probably most well known for. And we'll get to that. We'll get to that today. He lived 1672 to 1839, known by his main work as Chatam Sofer. Full name is Moshe Schreiber, one of the leading rabbis of leading Orthodox rabbis of European Jewry in the first half of the 19th century. Born in Frankfurt on Main in Germany, died in Pressburg, Moravia in 1839. He had a great deal of influence, as Furtzicker explains, in the Germany and the Hungarian Jewish communities. And as he'll explain here, he was, in terms of, he was probably almost by the, because he was there at the time, one of the most staunch opponents to the Reform movement. So hold on. Okay, so here, the way that Furtzicker writes the book, he doesn't have as many direct citations from the Chatam Sofer. I tried to include as many as I could to at least try to get primary sources, even if they are translated. But I did pick out some very important paragraphs in terms of describing, you know, as brief as we can exactly, or at least have some indication of how the Chatam Sofer operated. So I'll actually start here. During his own lifetime, he was recognized by many as the most authoritative voice in the flight of traditionalists to stem the advances of Reform Judaism and prevent Jews of his region, referring to Germany and Hungary, from becoming acculturated to the surrounding society. As such, he's considered the main architect of a new Orthodox approach to Jewish life. And according to Furtzicker, this is when you really first have the formations of what did it mean to be a, quote, Orthodox Jew, which would be a fairly new term. I mean, it's...
How did that get into gear? Who was responsible?
I don't know who was the very first person to use the term Orthodox. The way that Furtzicker tries to present things is from last week when we did, let's say, the Noda Yehuda as sort of the forerunners of Orthodoxy in terms of them laying a certain groundwork, he sees the Chatam Sofer as an ideological extension, or say a next generation of it, where he would, where you now have more clear dividing lines between us and them. So even if he wouldn't use the term Orthodox, which he probably didn't, in fact, I believe he, if I remember what Fritzinger said at the beginning of the book, the term Orthodox was something initially used by the Reform as a derogative or pejorative against the people who were more observant. But he's talking here not in terms of the a movement, so to speak, but as a social distinction of where was it formed from an ideological perspective of where you have one group of observant Jews versus another group of institutional non-observant Jews, and I have a clear distinction there. Yeah. Anyway, back here. After his death, his opinions were constantly cited by those claiming to follow his path as a justification for their positions. What Fritzinger is trying to do here is that since the point of his book is about the emergence of modern Jewish identity, he traces a lot of the isolationist approaches that you'll find in Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox Judaism to the Chatam Sofer. And he's sort of laying this out at the beginning of his chapter on the Chatam Sofer. In describing Sofer's opinion of those born Jewish who cease to live traditional lives, Jacob Katz comments, deviators automatically forfeited their right to be called Jews.
Very strong language.
Very strong language, which, and we're going to see this a little bit, you know, sort of elaborated. And also, you know, maybe it's not as clear of, we'll see. Try to make a little bit more of a nuance within Chatam Sofer from the, some of the stuff that Fritzinger is quoting here. But we at least, you know, lay the groundwork here in terms of the exclusion part of saying they lose their right to be considered Jews, or at least in the words of Jacob Katz. For those unfamiliar, Jacob Katz, really phenomenal Jewish historian. Any book that he's written is really worth writing. He wrote a lot on the evolution of halacha, in particular medieval, early modern periods and certain changes within halacha, like the book The Shabbos Goy is subtitled Case Studies in Halachic Flexibility. He's written Exclusiveness and Tolerance. A few other books come to mind, blanking off the top of my head, but really, you know, quote Jacob Katz, he's really one of the big Jewish historians, worthwhile knowing the name and a lot more of the books. Tradition Crisis, that was another one of his. Anyway, source number two here.
By the early decades of the 19th century, the last vestiges of coercive traditional society had ceased to exist in the larger German cities. It was no longer possible to enforce religious observance upon individuals. Those rabbinic courts that still existed dealt almost exclusively with ritual issues rather than civil ones. If non-observance was not yet the normative lifestyle of the majority throughout Germany, there were already cities where Sabbath desecrators were in the majority, while in all cities it was certainly no longer unusual behavior.
So you had more, certainly at a more popular level, you had fewer people, or either fewer people being observant, but certainly more people actively being non-observant in public, and the Jewish community itself lost its means of self-policing, so to speak. And if you recall from last week, it was one of the statements that Mendelssohn, you know, had advocated of, you know, not to have a coercive type of Jewish enforcement, or community shouldn't have, either shouldn't be doing that. Now, whether or not, you know, communities read Mendelssohn and said, hey, he's right, we shouldn't force people, is one thing. You could just as easily assume that, gradually speaking, Jewish communities start, you know, when you stop losing authority, that can happen pretty much naturally, just when people just stop listening or stop caring. Meaning how much people, you know, on the ground read Mendelssohn and woke up and had this massive epiphany versus started saying, hey, we just don't need to care about rabbis anymore. It's hard to say, but it was easy to peg Mendelssohn as the ideological problem and sort of like blame it on an individual. But from his perspective, right, you can see, well, the religious community as we know it is starting to break down and we've lost our means of enforcement. And this was something that I know we've spoken about in many other classes that we've had before here. but got a bunch of rabbis who just can no longer enforce people keeping Shabbos. How does that change what Judaism is, and how does that change how rabbis are going to be able to respond to people who aren't keeping halacha? Now,
I guess I'd like more detail on that whole thing, but maybe we can do it off lesson. I don't know.
Which whole thing?
Well, I mean, what was it that started that process of disintegration, and how did the disintegration actually play out on the micro level?
So,
you know, they put somebody in Ferem and nobody else in the shul listens?
I will throw out a couple of possible ideas. And the truth is, this is a question that I'm sure historians are going to debate. And not being a historian, you know, I'm just going to throw out some speculations as what are some things that could logically make sense, and this could just be anachronism. So I'm talking based on an intuition here. To really answer the question, you know, from an academic perspective, you would have to ask experts in the field who have really studied the texts and however they amass their data. One could simply be, as people learn more and, you know, take a secularization theory, as people learn more about the secular world and the secular theology, the religion can become less important in their lives. Right, you no longer need to go to the rabbi for answers to your big questions, so you no longer need to rely on the religion. Right, two, in an age where you have increased mobility and you're no longer stuck in the ghetto, as you would say, let's say someone puts you in Cherem in one neighborhood, there's very little, you know, at this point, because mobility has increased, you could pick up, go someplace else, and you could be fine. In theory, I mean, whether or not that happened, I mean, I could be overstating it, but I mean, you can see it happen today. One community puts you in a chayim, goes someplace else. When people are traveling a lot more, the rabbi's control over his domain is not going to be as strong because the individuals are constantly in flux.
Was there something specific that happened in Germany? I mean, I know in France we talk about the Napoleonic decrees or whatever that opened the society. Did something happen in Germany to make it more open?
Yeah, to make it more open in the sense of, you know, rabbinic authority.
Travel more and live where they wanted and go to schools and learn.
I don't know if it was a specific event as much as, you know, what's considered the time period.
Okay.
I'm sure historians better than myself might be able to track it, trace it down to this is the moment when things started to change. I don't know of that offhand. Take number three.
Both in portrayals written by followers and in modern historiography, the Chatam Sofer has become associated with a separatist orthodoxy that developed in Hungary in the second half of the 19th century. His approach is considered to be at the root of many of the extreme exclusionist positions that were later adopted by what has become known as Hungarian ultra-Orthodoxy.
Which, you know, the quotes are his. I didn't put that in quotes here. So we're talking here, you know, he's laying again the groundwork how the Chatam Sofer's opinions, whether or not people are going to cite back to the Chatam Sofer, which not everyone does. I mean, I don't know how many people read the Chatam Sofer in the original, but certainly laying the groundwork that people would follow his opinions, if not verbatim, but through, you know, at least you can trace it back to, you know, him saying us versus them type thing, the exclusionist type of attitudes towards the other. Yeah.
Indeed, he expressed the notion that deviants should be separated from the Jewish people. Apparently confronted by a new phenomenon, the elders of the community of Transylvania addressed the following query to the Chatam Sofer. What is the punishment for a public Sabbath desecrator? The Chatam Sofer's answer was vehement, seemingly leaving no room for interpretation. All Sabbath desecrators, who in a perfect halakhic society would face execution after conviction...
Well, we saw that before. You know, it's biblical. You know, I mean, granted, we don't actually it's very rare that a capital punishment would be met, but Torah does consider it to be a capital offense. Yeah.
Was there any civil punishment going on? Physical punishment?
Well, continue with the...
Did the Hungarian civil government allow rabbis to chop a guy's head off?
Read the quote here.
Should be dealt with as follows. So all Sabbath desecrators should be dealt with as follows.
Yes.
It is not in our power to judge capital cases. Rather, we must enlist the ministers of the government to force them to uphold the religion of Israel. Notwithstanding, if such a person will not listen, and the laws cannot be enforced, he is thus separated from the community of Israel and judged as having deserted the religion.
This is written by Chassam Sofer.
Yeah, anything that I indented here is a quote of the Chassam Sofer, translated by Furtziger.
He is no longer an Israelite, nor is he a Christian, nor Turk. Therefore, it is forbidden for any Israelite to eat in his home. The meat which he slaughters is prohibited. We do not accept his testimony, nor validate his oaths. Generally speaking, it is as if his name has been erased from Israel until he returns to God, who has mercy on him. All his food and drink have the status of being prohibited, b'cheskat isur, for he has lost his reliability.
Yeah.
The text does not indicate any considerations in the Chatzam Sofer's reasoning beyond the simple reality of an established Jewish community simultaneously confronting two new difficulties: a decline in the level of observance of some of its members, together with the loss of the traditional autonomous powers that would allow its guardians to discipline such deviants.
Now, does this make logical sense in terms of why we take this approach?
When I first started with following Orthodox Judaism, some rabbi, as I remember, said, "Why don't you move into this neighborhood here? You should move." And I'm thinking, "No, I don't want to do that because I'll be under his thumb. And this way, if I stay where I live, I can do my own thing."
Well, first of all, I think does your fantastic job of explaining just the pragmatism behind this. When you have a reality where you want to, you see that there is a threat to Orthodox Judaism, and that's, you know, a recurring theme that we say week in, week out. You know that people aren't being observant, but you have no idea what are you going to do with them. You can no longer control people or force them to observance, but if they stay there, then people's like, "Oh, we can just go." So the alternative is simply, well, we're just going to kick them out and say, "We're going to treat you as no longer Jewish." Meaning, we can't force you to change your actions because we have no social coercive powers, but what we can do is, you know, to borrow the phrase, remove you from our midst. And that's how we're going to solve the problem, right? So we say, there are no Sabbath desecrators in our shul. It's like, but that person's a Sabbath desecrator. Kick him out. There are no Sabbath desecrators in our shul. Because if you, and you can understand why, you know, how this would solve the threat of non-observance.
Did you ever actually have one yenta or some guy saying, "I saw this guy go on the bus on Shabbos"?
In our shul? No. I mean, our shul, because our shul attracts a lot of different types of people, not everyone who comes here is Shomer Shabbat, and people understand that. We have Shomer Shabbat people, we have people who aren't, and
it's understood,
and we'll talk a little bit later, about what are ways of, contemporary ways of dealing with people who are dealing with people's a bad bad term. It's relating to people would be a better choice of phrase here, who aren't Sabbath observers. But don't forget, in his day, right, you're talking about a relatively new threat of a certain type of non-observance, which we started seeing, last week too. I mean, people, common threat years back, and we'll actually see Chatzam Sofer addressing this, would be, say, converting to Christianity. But in terms of, like, embracing atheism and secularism was a relatively new challenge, and people weren't necessarily sure how to respond. If someone converted to Christianity, there wasn't even a question. The person pecked up and removed himself from Judaism because he accepted another God. But what does it mean to, say, reject one religion without necessarily accepting another? That seems to have been a newer type of, category that they had to deal with here. Not ideologically, of course, because, you could have left Judaism at any time in the previous thousand some odd years. But this seemed to have been a much more established movement that they had to contend with. Yeah.
Lots of questions.
Okay.
First of all, a reforming Jew, might not even, he certainly won't say, "I'm joining a new religion," but he probably also wouldn't say, "I'm leaving Judaism."
Mm-hmm.
He'd say, "I belong to a different branch of Judaism."
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Secondly, So, all right. So you tell everybody in your shul that not to eat his shechita or whatever, not to eat at his house or something.
Yeah.
How would it have been different 100 years before? Would you have said the same thing? It's just that it would have carried more weight because the guy had no place to go.
Probably.
Or would you have punished him more harshly somehow?
It would depend where. I mean, I would guess if you had had some shtetl that could mete out certain social ostracizations.
Don't
you know,
talk to the guy. No one should even.
Or don't do business with the guy. Mm. You know, you could have really affected, you know, the whole livelihood, especially if you just had a close, small, tight knit Jewish community, or for lack of a better term, a ghetto. You know, where you just had, you know, one walled off group. This is the Jewish community, and if you got kicked out, it was a pretty big deal.
And then the last thing is what Ed raised about today in the shul.
Yeah.
So let's suppose somebody sees somebody getting on a bus on Shabbos.
Mm-hmm.
So that person will then find an excuse not to eat at his house if he's invited.
The contemporary interpersonal relations is something we'll get to in a couple. We'll get there eventually. So we will. So let's leave it at that for now.
Okay. There's something very loathsome to me in forming a network of spies and finks that come to the rabbi and say, I saw this guy do this. Another squealer comes in and say, I saw this person do that.
Well, a lot of that's going to
creepy society.
A lot of that's going to depend on your community dynamic. And for that, we'll have to talk about, you know, when we get to, you know, in a while, we'll get to, like, different types of Orthodox communities. With here, at least, because, I mean, the Sanctuary Shul is at least a very honest shul. You know, people know where they are, they know where everyone else is, and, you know, they respond and they respect each other accordingly. Meaning, you know, someone, not going to mention who in the shul, no, doesn't keep kosher, you know, understands why I'm not going to go eat in his house. And we're okay with that. As opposed to, say, other shuls where, you know, rabbi doesn't, people can get really offended. And there are actually some rabbis who have a public policy of never eating in anyone's house, just so that they don't have an issue.
No one can say anything.
But here, due to the variance and because people are very honest, people know, like, I keep kosher, sure, I'll have people over. I don't keep kosher, I'm not going to invite people over. And it's almost, I mean, we have an unusual level of respect of individuals here in the synagogue that you would elsewhere. And there could be some places that can say we're too open and too tolerant of that, but we can deal with such judgment calls a little bit. Well, we'll actually get to a bit of that today. But you can think about that as an underlying implicit question in subsequent weeks. Despite his well-known dictum that Ed said at the very beginning, that which is new is biblically forbidden. Chadash asur min haTorah. So the reference to that is you know, new grain. It refers to, like, grains that are new is where he's citing it from. There was one professor that I know who said regarding this use of it is ein chidush gedula mizo. There is nothing. There is no greater innovation bigger than this to say that there is no innovation or anything new is forbidden. Because, I mean, look, if really not everything new was really forbidden, like, up until when? Or, you know, the way I would put it from my tech perspective, once you say nothing new is forbidden, this was the latest change in Judaism. From a tech perspective, you'd call it a code freeze. Like, all changes up until now were okay, now we're closing the book, nothing else is allowed. However, important to note here, that Sofer did not reflexively condemn anything novel in his generation. As an example, the practice of removing beards did not bother him as long as it did not violate any halachic norms. On July 21st, 1800, Chatam Sofer wrote a responsum in which he confronted a colleague who complained to people in his community who were clean-shaven. Sofer retorted that, quote, regarding your attack, sorry about that, on the clean-shaven, what is all this uproar? For it, such a prohibition, is not to be found in the Talmud and the later authorities post him that shaving should serve as a differentiation between Jews and non-Jews. Mm. So what's important to realize is, if you want to paint Chatam Sofer as just a reactionary,
he's not when it comes to the shaving issue.
Right. So, I mean, again, you could probably write your, you know, several theses and books on the Chatam Sofer in his own right, but it's important to at least show one example to prove that he was not purely a reactionary. And you can see to what extent he was or he wasn't, but it's important to throw in enough gray to realize there's more nuance than just saying anything that changes from what our contemporary society does is in of itself bad simply because it's not what people are doing.
I ran across an older guy, and I talked about shaving, electric shaving. Permissible. He says, no, I go to a special guy in Chinatown because he knows how to adjust the shaver, and so it's kosher. The ordinary, this guy's too machmir for me. I just thought I'd mention.
Well, I'll put a very quick digression here. This is like completely off topic about the whole shaving thing. One of the issues that came up was with a lift and cut deal with Norelco. Difference being with shaving, the prohibition against shaving is specifically with a razor. So with a straight razor.
Well, that's what they had in those days.
Right. So a straight razor, sorry for the people who are listening, you don't get the visual aid, but imagine a stick facing up, and a razor is when you just do it. Like a blade, a sheath, something like that, a sickle in the field, one thing going like this, just straight cutting it down, as opposed to what many electric shavers do is a scissor action, where you don't just have one blade, you are breaking the hair against a stationary metallic body. The problem with the lift and cut was, if you followed the commercials, if you remember the old graphics from the Norelco thing, you had one blade that would hold it while another blade would cut underneath it, which would seem to mimic a razor. Ruth Tendler in a class explained that this is the difference between Madison Avenue Halacha and actually knowing Halacha, where he took the Norelco shaver, he took it apart, and he said, I don't see how this does what the picture says it does. Now, whether or not, in terms of the lift and cut, whether or not it's still lifting and cutting, the way that he saw it when he was at the end, it's still breaking it against the stationary piece of metal, the thin thing, which means it functions more as a scissor as opposed to a razor.
So it's permissible by Tendler.
Because it didn't do what he's. The way that he put it was, if the ad was true, or at least if that's exactly the way it operates, it's not that electric shavers are bad, but the Norelco lift and cuts are bad. Mm. Whereas other types of rotary ones that do function as, don't even pretend otherwise, would certainly be fine with a lift and cut. He said, you know what, this is, it doesn't do what I say it does. And even if you get the buzzers, like the clippers that might just be a flat thing, it basically is scissors that go back and forth really fast, and that's what's doing the cutting. It's not the pushing down on it. Complete digression, but interesting enough that it's the warrants being recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, back to our topic at hand. Number five. Ed?
Clearly all his decisions were based on halakhic precedent. Right. Yet his choices of when to adopt a strict position and when to be lenient are telling. By allowing the soldier, a circumcised Jew, who wore a cross indicating apostasy.
I summarized, the previous paragraphs in the book. There was a soldier who had a brit, was considered on one hand Jewish, but he was wearing a cross, which seemed to indicate that he accepted Christianity. And he was buried in a Jewish cemetery, which you would think shouldn't be allowed. But separate issue, yeah.
Should I continue?
Yes.
By allowing the soldier to be buried among the Jews, he had already been buried, Sofer affirmed the basic Jewish identity of this sinner. No matter how far he had distanced himself in his lifetime from Jewish observance, he remained attached to the Jewish people. Essentially, through his ruling, the Chassam Sofer erected two boundaries, one external and one internal. He maintained the historic border between the Jewish and the Gentile worlds, and he established an additional one, which served to distinguish between those who had adopted the ways of the Gentile world and those who he referred to as full-fledged Israelites.
Right. So even if, it's one thing, this is a really fascinating distinction for the Chassam Sofer to make here. The first point, the first sentence in this paragraph, I think, is very crucial, where all his decisions were based on halakhic precedent. When you kick someone out of the community for public Sabbath desecrations, as we saw when we did the rabbinic sources, you know, he didn't just pull that out of the blue. He is relying on something. He's not making up, you know, he's not making up halakha. He's applying it in a certain way. Mm-hmm. But there are times when he's going to be more lenient than others. Example in this case here, and he's making two distinctions. One is Jew and non-Jew, and the other is between whatchamacallit.
Last Jew and actively following the halakha.
Yeah. And, you know, so when he refers to these types of Jews who are outside of the Jewish community, it's in a way almost a kind of a grayish area relative to what? Yes, they're not Jews compared to the full-fledged Israelites, as he put it, but they're still Jewish when you compare them to the Christians in a way. Right, so it's it seems to be almost a liminal stage, for lack of a better term, where they don't really fit in to either place, or alternatively, depending on what halakha you're talking about, is going to depend on which ones you're going to which halakha you apply. Give me a second to find the correct phrasing of this. You need to apply different halakha to this particular individual in terms of Take a step back. Different halakha would be applicable in terms of what is your point of contrast. Meaning, if your point of contrast is compared to a non-Jew, you treat him for certain halakha like a Jew. But in other things, you treat him like a non-Jew relative to other types of halakha. Thank you. It's going to get that out eventually. Yeah.
So the dictum of Yisrael achal pishachata Yisraelu.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how would that apply, you know, if somebody, let's say, had theoretically, in an ideal society, had been killed for desecrating the Shabbos,
mm-hmm.
would he be buried in the Jewish cemetery?
As far as I know, I mean, when I looked into this, and I could be missing something here, but as far as a rabbinic prohibition against burying with other Jews, I don't know where one exists. And I don't know what would necessarily disqualify that. I asked once, and colleagues, and I never got back what I considered a satisfactory answer, meaning there's certainly a cultural thing that's attached to it, but I don't know offhand of a rabbinic source where I can say there's a rabbinic prohibition against burying a certain individual in a Jewish cemetery or amongst other Jews.
But what if he converted?
Outside? I don't know where the sages specifically designate a certain area as a, quote, Jewish cemetery.
Oh, no, but Yisrael achal pishachata.
Yes.
If he converts, is he still Yisrael?
So, in halakha, I mean, yes, in the sense that he is still a halachic Jew, and, you know, yeah.
Okay.
And that's kind of the whole point there. And Rambam uses, I believe, that idiom by a convert even. So even the convert goes back. Assuming the conversion at the time was done properly, and the person goes back to, you know, the old religion or whatever one, it's still considered a legitimate conversion, and it's just as if an Israelite who sinned, and it doesn't undo the conversion. Okay. Then take number six.
Early in his career, the Chatam Sofer introduced an additional component into his approach toward sinners, namely the offspring of these sinners. In a halachic essay completed on August 8, 1801, Sofer examined the oft-discussed question of whether to punish a sinner according to the letter of the law when it was likely that this would push him to apostasy. He posited that if the only concern was that the sinner himself would be lost to the Jewish people, he was inclined not to worry about the reaction of the guilty individual. Often, however, there were Jewish children involved who would naturally follow the teachings of their parents and be lost to Judaism. In such cases, he affirmed a lenient approach. For how can we, quote, push away with our own hands a falling stone that will cause his sons to go to the grave?
So let's put a pause here, and this kind of goes back to your question about what do you do in terms of, like, informing other people. From a more pragmatic perspective, how do you deal with a non-observant Jew? So Chatam Sofer, at least according to this citation, says, well, if it's just him, well, we can afford to let an individual go because, you know, one individual, you know, it's for the sake of needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one of the few, if I can quote Spock in Star Trek. But if you're not, if let's say, you know, the person has a family, person might raise a family, if you make this individual hate Judaism and exclude this person entirely, you don't just lose him, you lose all the kids. And do you really want to do that? Or does that really help at the end? And there's a certain, you know, foresightedness that when you view, you know, someone who is considered to be a very staunch opponent of reform, also recognized that it's not just us versus them and, you know, we need to kick them all out, because he realizes, wait, there are other generations that you still could have influence on. If you want to have influence on them, you know, you can't just push them away entirely. However, continue with a very notable exception here.
Yet the Chatam Sofer did not leave this as a blanket allowance. Regarding the Sabbateans and their children, the Sofer ignored this factor, declaring, quote, "A further distinction must be made. For surely an evildoer who is a sectarian and heretic abandoner of the Torah, one can be almost positive, will teach his false beliefs to his children. Then one can logically conclude that there is no reason to be concerned for the children. Thus it appears to me that the accursed sect of believers in Shabtai Tzvi should be pursued with their sons and daughters. It is preferable that they be separated from the community of exiles, that they mix with the Gentiles, they and their children. It would be considered a grand mitzvah if, while they are still among the Jews, their bread be the prohibited bread of Kutites, and their wine be the prohibited wine of libation."
Right. So here there's actually a distinction that he's making, to be more precise, between a Jew who decides to embrace secular life or just reject your Judaism, for lack of a better term, or just is no longer observant, versus someone who is a student of Shabtai Tzvi or a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, because the difference is, in one case, you've just, let's say, you know, remove the yoke of Judaism. In another, you've embraced something antithetical to Judaism. And this kind of helps explain the sort of liminal status here in terms of, if to make an analogy to hefker, if you will, in Jewish law. In Jewish law, if you have an item, you can make something hefker, which makes it ownerless. But in order to transfer ownership, someone else needs to pick it up. It's why, you know, there's a whole bunch of lumdos as to why bitul chametz, right, Pesach, isn't just hefker. Because it's not enough to take something out of your possession for you to just give it away. Someone else needs to physically come up and take it. So kind of in a similar analogy here too, the absence of Judaism isn't the same as the presence of something necessarily a bad form of Judaism. Meaning, if you're taught incorrectly, that's worse than just leaving Judaism entirely. Because if you just leave Judaism or are raised secular, you can still teach them, here's what Judaism is. But once you've been taught and raised in a flawed Judaism, that's much more difficult. And that we assume that you're going to have taught your kids, and that's going to be a lot harder to undo. And for those, he's willing to, or at least for Sabbateans, I'm trying to extrapolate, you know, he's willing to basically cut the losses because you've already poisoned the kids' minds, as opposed to a secularist. No. Yeah, I'll put it on again just for, you know, my own thing, as my own, you know, position in the rabbinate. It's a lot easier to teach someone from scratch than it is to correct a mistake or a mistaken teaching. And there's gemaras about this too. And by mistaken teaching, there are a lot of ways to be a mistake. And I don't mean to say necessarily that I know more than someone else. But there are certainly times where I think people have been taught incorrectly. For example, anyone who comes to me with a certain theological assumption, saying, "Isn't this how God operates?" because they were told, "This is how God operates." I can say, you know, might have been taught wrong there, because no one can say definitively how God operates. Right? So people can be dealing with certain flawed assumptions. Or if you want to, you know, look at, say, more extreme views of Judaism, I mean, if you disagree with them, by implication, you're going to say you were taught wrong. But once you have certain ideas ingrained in your system, it's much harder to undo those, with one possible exception. There was a debate on a Jewish education listserv many years ago about whether or not it's better to teach high school kids plurality, multiplicity of opinions, or one mahalich, one approach. And a friend of mine, whom I respect greatly as an educator, just brilliant guy all around, took the opinion that, no, it's probably better from an educational perspective to teach one mahalech, one approach, because that way they'll at least have something solid. You encourage them to learn in the future and learn more, but they'll always have a baseline that they can start adjusting.
Yeah.
Whereas on, you know, at a certain level when people are at the formative periods and they're starting putting stuff together, if you hit them with everything at once, they have no idea how to process information, and it's just all relative. Mm-hmm. Right? But if you take it aside, there's a difference between given an approach and being indoctrinated with the assumption that this is the truth to the exclusion of all others, yeah. Which is what Sabbateans kind of did. Right?
Or when you're being, I met it too.
Right, or when you're talking about anyone who says, my approach is correct and every other one is illegitimate. Now, there's a difference between saying illegitimate versus here's how I would respond. Like, say, even in shul here, I'm, you know, try to be very careful not to delegitimize, you know, large swaths of people, but I will say, here's why I disagree with them. Like, here's what they say, try to present as best as I can, try to explain their reasoning as best as I understand it, and to say, here's where we disagree, which is very different than saying, these people aren't Jewish, or these people aren't halachic. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a very different approach here. Paragraph 7 here, the analogy between Reform and the historic list of sectarians who eventually split off from Judaism was used once again in Chatam Sofer's strongest and most quoted statement regarding the status of Reformers. Quote, if we had the power over them, in my opinion, would be to separate them from us, our borders. We should not give our daughters to their sons, and their sons should not be accepted for our daughters, so as not to be drawn after them. Their sect should be considered like those of Tzadok and Baitus, Anan and Saul, and they among themselves will be among, they will be among themselves, we will be among ourselves. All this appears correct according to the law, halacha, but not in practice, la ma'aseh, for without permission of the king, my words have no authority. So he sort of, on one hand, he's saying,
he's really screaming, and then he knocks himself.
He's not knocking himself down. He's saying, ideally, these people, like Reformers, aren't just saying that, you know, aren't saying that ditch Judaism. In his mind, they are presenting a Judaism, or a version of Judaism, that is antithetical to halakha, antithetical to Jewish law, not unlike the Sabbateans.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In that you're creating, there's a new branch or a new form of Judaism. Why he mentioned here specifically, you know, Tzadok and Baitus, which, you know, we saw, you know, back in the Chazal periods and how people attributed them, they weren't people who said, we're no longer Jewish. They were variants of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And they're considered just as those are sects that we're going to keep out, so too we are going to keep them out. He is, however, acknowledging that practically we can't isolate ourselves because we know what, we don't have the political clout, but lacking that political clout can probably make us a little more, for lack of a better term, sympathetic to the type of rhetoric he would use. Because if I can't actually enforce what I say, I'm going to use much harsher rhetoric to make sure that people realize, oh, this is the worst thing ever. If I can't force you to do something by means of social coercion, I can try to get inside your head, or at least if not, and the point here isn't to try to tell Reformed Jews you're wrong, meaning he's not trying to convince them they're wrong, and he's not trying to bring them back, and he's not trying to engage in a public debate. What he is trying to do is saying, you're beyond, he's telling his own community, right?
Don't bother with them.
Exactly. Like, we're cutting our, they are basically, you know, they're leaving us, just bad news.
I do enjoy his passion. You know, like,
well, you can understand why the passion is necessary, because you see there's a real threat. You don't have any real power to stop them other than to be as vociferous as possible. And he admits, my words have no authority, because at the end of the day, you could just as easily ignore Chatam Sofer as you could ignore anyone else.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, in a sense, you know, it's a realization, I think, rabbis think that there's no reason why you have to listen to one rabbi or the other. It gets in people's head, and people do realize this eventually, that rabbis get up and say stupid things too often, you start ignoring the rabbi. And I know of a recent case of a synagogue where a rabbi said a whole lot of stupid things and the shul fired him. Right? You know, it and there's a certain cognizance of his own limitations there. So he's passionate with a certain degree of pragmatism as well. Yeah.
Who were Anan and Saul?
So Anan would refer to I think the Karaites, I believe. You know, they were called the Karaites. I'm not sure I don't know what he's referring to by Saul. Could be referring to even Christianity, possibly.
Oh, sure.
That's my guess. I honestly don't know.
Became Paul.
Right.
Yeah. It's a guess in my hand. I'm not sure. You know, which is why I focus on Sadduk and Vitus, because at least we saw those, at least in the historical tradition. And that also goes back to something, a point Kurtziger made earlier. He's not saying anything new. I mean, not a pandar and chadash or sur mina Torah. He's not really being innovative. He's using classical texts and ideas and applying them to what he perceives to be a threat to Judaism, of not just people leaving the faith, but people taking the faith in a way that he sees as very dangerous. And having at least the historical memory of Sabbateanism, people following the false Messiah, there's a real concern of, oh, a new form, a new branch of Judaism is going to pop up.
What year was Sabbateanism?
So the dates I have are Shabtai Tzvi, were 1626 to 1676.
Got it. Thank you.
All right, but it's still part of their historical memory, and they were still dealing with the aftereffects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, enough that Hassam Sofer had to write a response against people who were still following Shabtai Tzvi.
Yeah, this would have been
even after the guy converted to Muslim.
You're talking about almost 100 years after he died too.
And they had people hanging in.
Look, people. Look, for lack of a better analogy, I mean, people still followed Jesus after how many years after he died. So, it's not uncommon. You know, people really believed it. Or, to put it from also a practical standpoint, look at how Chatam Sofer explained it. If you have a family that believe, or someone believed in Shabtai Tzvi, he has a family, raises kids. How does he educate their kids? Follow Shabtai Tzvi, right? Mm-hmm. So it keeps on perpetuating,
right?
Same thing with Christianity. Someone believes in Jesus. How do they educate their kids? Believe in Jesus. There you go, right? It just, for a whole lot of other reasons, Christianity was perpetuated itself, and Sabbateanism, as far as I know, has died out. I don't know of any Jew who, or I shouldn't say any Jew, I don't know of anyone today who follows Shabtai Tzvi. Although I did meet a friend of mine who thinks,
I don't remember the Don Meh, they originated.
I don't know.
Look it up on Wikipedia.
Sure. All right. So according to the Wikipedia entry on the Don Meh, it refers to a group of crypto-Jews in the Ottoman Empire, present-day Turkey, openly affiliated with Islam, practiced a form of Judaism called Sabbateanism. Right. Group originated during and soon after the era of Shabtai Tzvi, 17th century Jewish Kabbalists who claimed to be the Messiah, eventually forced by the Ottoman Emperor, Ottoman Sultan Mehmed IV to become a Muslim, yada, yada, yada. Followed him to Islam and became the Don Meh. So there you go.
I think they still exist.
Yeah, do they consider themselves Jews? That would be the question.
Yeah, I have a feeling they do.
Oh. I honestly have never encountered one. Again, if anyone wishes to pay for me to go to Turkey to investigate, I won't say no. I'll finish off with the last source here. Within the world of non-ideological transgressors, Chatam Sofer further distinguished between transgressors and full-fledged converts to Christianity. Sofer explained that a public Sabbath desecrator was a mumar regarding the entire Torah, and on that basis was forbidden to circumcise and ritual slaughter. His testimony is disqualified, but he emphasized that there was still a great difference between such a transgressor and those who formally converted to Christianity. The major practical ramifications of this distinction was in regard to the relationship of observant Jews to these two types of deviants. It was permissible to marry the children of public Sabbath desecrators, while apostates had cut off their offspring as well from the Jewish people. Quote, as to their daughters too, we must distinguish between an apostate who had polluted himself amongst the Gentiles, for he is essentially like a Gentile, kenochri mamash, while if he is an Israelite, it is possible that his sons will not follow him. All right? So even within the Chatam Sofer, for as much as he's considered to be so much against the reform and against innovation, he himself had a certain realization of don't push, there's a certain limit to how much you push people away. Yes, he's going to use hyperbole to say they're no longer part of the Jewish community, but he still had in the back of his head, there's still hope for the kids and they're still Jewish for certain things when it comes right down to it. later generations, though, as you know, I'm sure Fritzig is going to get into, people are still going to take the only the exclusivist approach of the Tam Sofer to say how anyone who's different than us ought to be cast aside, ignoring the other half of what he says, which is, you know, not uncommon in fundamentalism, where I don't think anyone's a fundamentalist as much as a selective fundamentalist. You're going to take out the few words that you like or that are most convenient for you. You're going to be fundamentalist regarding those points to the exclusion of everything else. So it's important, though, and I think Fritzinger does a wonderful job of getting across the nuance of Chatam Sofer, of how he's trying to address the problems on a practical level in terms of isolating the non-religious Jews, both the ones who accepted another form of Judaism versus those who just are no longer observant, contrasting both of those with non-Jews entirely, while realizing that, one, he has no power of conversion, and also recognizing that even if you lose one person, there still may be hope for children, and have a certain degree of consideration behind that. All right? So we're not going to have any class next week because of Purim, and we'll pick up in 2 weeks, I believe, with Rabbi Akiva Eger. All right? Have a wonderful week. Purim Sameach. Don't forget, Tanit Esther is on Thursday.